When I was invited, I thought, well, this should be easy. We're using a lot of genomic information. I've talked about genomics a lot. So just pull out a talk and give it. And I made a mistake, because the first thing I did was I Googled the title of my talk, What the Beef Industry Can Learn About Genomics from Other Industries. So the first thing that came was this ad here that came from this Australian journal, Beef Central. And looks like they got mixed up just a little bit, but it says what can the beef industry learn from the sale of a $251,000 dairy heifer? So the fact that she was very, very young, and the fact that she sold for a lot of money, and the fact that she was she was there in Australia and then bought by a U.S. company. So they say, wow, somebody's spending a lot of money on these animals. There must be something to learn from this industry. And you can see in this ad, or maybe you can see in this ad, it says the highest ever GTPI, so that's Genomic Total Performance Index, that's the U.S. Overall breeding measure. So that's the U.S. information that's being presented at an Australian sale. So in this article, here's some of the quotes that they made. They said nearly every dairy bull worldwide is chosen for widespread use. It's based upon genomic predictions. Even Canada and Europe are using the U.S. genomic discovery systems to identify their top genetics. The traits that we measure, milk production, you know, cows get milked 2-3 times a day, so we have lots of measurements on the cows, so the traits are easy to measure. This is a no-brainer. It's party time in the U.S. dairy industry. And that was the first thought that I got of what you may be thinking as beef people about the dairy industry, is that, oh, it's real easy. So then I read Jerry Taylor's paper. He came up there when I Googled the name of the talk, and he has these quotes in there. Holsteins are the genomic selection poster cows. Genomic selection was a technology waited to be invented for the U.S. dairy industry. So again, here we are in the dairy industry. Genomics comes along. We're just sitting back. It falls in our lap. We start using it. We start selling animals for $250,000. This is really, really easy. And to further point that out in Jerry's scientific article here, and you can see that I have presented here the exact same paper that Daniela presented, the one from Mewison, Hayes, and Goddard. So that was definitely a key publication that sparked much interest. So the graphs that are presented here, one graph is how many references there were to that original Mewison's paper, so that goes up. The other graph is how many genotypings occurring in the dairy industry once we got that SNP chip. That goes up. And another one of those graphs is the genetic improvement for milk production. And that goes up. So it seems like everything just kind of came together, and it was real, real easy. So knowing that you guys think it's real easy, I wanted to get up here and whine and complain and tell you how hard we're working. And when we look at ourselves, we don't think that it's party time. We think that, oh my goodness, we really have to work and adapt and change our thinking and even compete harder. So I want to give you a bit of the inside story within the dairy industry. And so this is a popular website that has articles, and it had stories about how genomics is drastically changing the AI industry, how genomics is drastically changing the industry for the breeders, the registered breeders that are trying to produce seed stock that then goes on and propagates that genetics to everybody, that the genomics has totally changed their world upside down, that the guys that were at the top have to struggle to stay at the top. There's a lot of new players that have entered into the producing top genetics, and that's the story I kind of want to emphasize. So before I get into the struggles and the competitions and the results of those struggles and competitions, I do want to emphasize how happy we are to have genomic information and to encourage the beef industry to go full steam ahead in adopting it. The only caveat that they have there is once you start going down that road, you realize how quickly things change. So the industry is changing very fast, and I've broken up the conclusions into two parts. One is if you're a cold-blooded, hard person like a dairy geneticist, you say, well, gee, the data structure's changed. I have to change my models. Or if you're like everybody else, you say, gee, the industry has really changed, and there's some business opportunities that weren't there that are before that are now here. There's an opportunity for me to grab more market share, or my market share is being taken away from me. And if I don't get on board with this genomics, if I don't really adopt it and use it very hard, very aggressively, very enthusiastically, my livelihood could actually be threatened. So it really is having a big impact on the dairy industry, and I think that's what you really wanted to hear about is, okay, well, what's going on? Now, obviously, you can do some planning, and we have tried to do planning, and we do planning, but really a lot of what's happening now within the dairy industry, once the genomics has come about, is we're adjusting, we're adapting, we're competing, and there are some that you would say that they've won very, very well, and then those that maybe have won just a little bit. And the reason why I have real winners and winners just a little bit, there's really no losers. I mean, there's no question we've greatly improved the dairy breeds and the dairy cattle, and we're doing it very, very fast. And so you have to say that the dairy industry and the people within the dairy industry are winning. There's just some that are maybe winning a little bit more than others. So here's the how everybody is winning. When we look at the genetic progress, and we could measure that by the average net merit dollar, how much those bulls average net merit dollar per bull increases per year. So in the time period before genomic selection, it was going up about $19. This is on the marketed bulls. And then with a little bit of that early genomic information, we did see an increase. And then when the genomic information is really being utilized intensively, it's the average bull that comes in year after year after year is so much better than the bull that we had the year before. So we're rapidly churning over our population. We're seeing great strides in this is profitability, lifetime profitability. So we're all winners from that perspective. There's many ways that we're using the genomic information. Here's just a few. It helps us get better accuracy on the genetic merit of animals. We are able to manage inbreeding better. Undesirable genetic defects, we're able to identify them and then reduce them to a low frequency. Breed composition, you do a lot of crossbreeding in the beef industry. Supposedly we do little, but you'll see that breed composition has become an important part of our industry. And we have these other things that I'll try to touch briefly on. I have this slide here. This is on the genetic conditions. And there's one key is that what's the frequency of undesirable genetic conditions that are out there? From a paper from Van Raden and Miller, it's about one in every five animals will have some undesirable genetic condition. So we're able to find them quickly, and the key is that if it's at that type of frequency, we have to abandon our old way of thinking of if an animal is identified with an undesirable genetic condition, then you shouldn't use them. So that is passé. Now, when we identify that an animal has an undesirable genetic condition, it's, well, how do we manage the use of that animal so it doesn't hurt us? In other words, avoid carrier-to-carrier mating, test a lot of his offspring, and then try to, over time, decrease the frequency of that undesirable gene and keep the desirable genes at a high level. So you need to put the information out, make it easily accessible. This is probably more for the scientific community, but what we have here is the name of the condition, the gene name, the frequency, what chromosome, the exact location on the chromosome, and some references. And you'll notice that on the names, there's a lot of them that are HHO, HH1, HH2, HH3. Now, when we first discovered those were, as Daniela said, a block of DNA. And within that block of DNA, there was something that was causing early embryonic death. Now, over time, we know exactly what it is, and we know what gene it is, and we could come up with a new name, and we purposely have not renamed them. We still refer to them as Holstein haplotype 1, Holstein haplotype 2. And the reason why we do that is more marketing than it is anything else. We believe that we've kind of have an advantage or a head start in understanding this information. But when you try to market an animal that you have labeled as having an undesirable genetic condition, it eliminates the market for a lot of these animals. But if you don't call it an undesirable genetic condition, you don't call it a recessive trait, you just call it a haplotype, then you still have access to many, many markets around the world. So it was a purposeful decision not to call them undesirable recessives, but to stay with the original name of haplotypes. And the reason why that I'm really emphasizing don't go overboard on eliminating bulls that may be carriers is that here's one that's recent. It's the haplotype associated with cholesterol deficiency. So many of these animals die before they're born, but those that are born alive, they look normal at birth. But then as they go on, you see that no matter what you do, they seem to be getting skinnier and skinnier and skinnier until some other condition does them in. But they're not able to absorb lipids. They're not able to put any fat on their body, and that gets them in the end. So what I have here is a PTA, chromosomal PTA display. So we have the 30 chromosomes of the cow, and for each chromosome we have whether it's a pink, means that that chromosome came from the mother, or it's blue, that chromosome came from the father. And then what's the net merit value of that chromosome that came from each of the parents? And if you look at chromosome 11, the pink came from the mother, and within that chromosome, that's actually the chromosome that's the best chromosome for net merit dollars. So if you have a breeding program, that's the one that you want if you're using that bull storm. Unfortunately, contained in that chromosome is this haplotype or this allele that affects cholesterol deficiency. So the strategy really now in the genomics era is to identify who are the carriers of this condition, do a genomic test. If they're really, really high and they are a carrier, keep them and use them. Get descendants of that animal, do another genomic test, and start slowly weeding out that allele from the population. Don't do it immediately, but do it over the long term. And if it's a older mutation, one that's further back, you can eliminate it very quickly. If it's a new mutation, it's going to take several more years to do that. The idea is, again, to get the information out there. So this would be publicly displayed many different ways. This just happens to be the one that's on the Holstein website. And you have one of our most popular bulls called Montross. He's free of all the undesirable genetic conditions. But if he did have one undesirable genetic condition, we would still encourage people to use this bull because of all the other 29,999 desirable alleles that he does have. And by getting the information out to breeders by genomic testing, by them knowing whether their animals that they're going to mate to a particular bull as a carrier, does have an impact. You can see if the dam is untested, about 6.5% result in a carrier-to-carrier mating. That's cut down to in half to about 3%. If you have just by having the dam tested, which means that those owners are more cognizant of perhaps a mating of carrier to carrier, and they avoid it whether the bull is a carrier or not. And then three times less likely if the dam is known to be a carrier to avoid the bulls that are a carrier. So that's how you manage a undesirable recessive as opposed to just automatically eliminate animals. And what we have here is that it does work. This is how the allele frequency for those undesirable recessives are decreasing. And then the next part is using the information competitively. So when you get this genomic information, yes, you think of breed improvement. Yes, you think of improving the industry. But it's more personal than that. You want to improve your farm, improve your company, improve your country. And that's done in having something that's better than your contemporaries. And so the genomic information is quite interesting because you have it and it's available to not only to you but to many others. So I have here Germany, and I'm going to describe the German breeding program. And the reason why I want to do that is because it's basically identical to the U.S. breeding program. So they describe it from 2010 on. They say everybody has genomic proofs. They say who we're using as parents are 90% young sires, as sires of sons. The bull mothers are 90% yearling heifers that are genomically tested. Overall, the farmers are using 50 to 90% young genomic AI bulls. So what that means is that they don't have any records themselves. They don't have any daughters with records. They just have the genomic test and the pedigree information. And that's basically what we're doing in every other major dairy country in the world. And then just a little bit more as far as who are the sires of the bulls. 100% of them are young sires. So we totally believe in the genomic information. When you look at the overall population, 70% within Germany are using young genomic bulls, not proven bulls, but young genomic bulls. So how can the U.S. compete if everybody is doing exactly the same thing? We saw this slide earlier, and it's like, you know, everybody can look at the same thing and get a different interpretation. Yes, this is great, but what I see when I look at this is, man, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of people aggressively pursuing genetic improvement. That's a lot of people really embracing this genomic information. That's a lot of animals. It's, as you mentioned, it's 1.6 million Holsteins genotyped. And not only are the animals genotyped, but the bull that I have there below, he's genotyped for, let's see, 5 generations. So we have 5 generations of genotyped ancestors. Genomic predictions have been around for 8 years. So obviously some of them we've gone back and genotyped them. But it's this belief in the genomic information, this willingness to use it very aggressively, and this belief that we should pursue genetic improvement that is really the key message and a simple message that the dairy industry would have. A little bit more to show and try to demonstrate that genomics will change your industry, and that's the thing that people say, but let's see it within the dairy industry. So here's a pedigree of a popular bull, proven bull that's now available. I love his name. It's Numero Uno. If you're going to be a top bull, you should be called Numero Uno. And what you see here is that we have a very international pedigree. If you go back to the last generation there on the dam side. You can see you have a Canadian bull sired, bred to a German cow who produced an Italian offspring. Those Italian offspring were bred to a U.S. bull, and then you also have included in there the bull Schottel that came from Great Britain. So a very international pedigree. And again, from the dairy community, everybody trying to improve their country, this is basically what we were doing. We were looking all around the world trying to find the best genetics. When we found them, we used them, and everybody was doing something similar. Now, it really has changed. What I have here is the pedigree of a top bull. This bull is owned and bred by Select Sires. So that SSI, Select Sires Incorporated. And what you see there is not only is that bull owned and bred by Select Sires, but the sire and the paternal granddam and the paternal great granddam also bred by Select Sires. And on the dam side, you see multiple generations. So there's four generations of AI bred females since in the genomics era. The genomics era is only 8 years old, and we have a bull now that's four generations old of AI breeding. And that's dramatic. That's dramatic because in the dairy industry, previous to genomics, all of the bulls were basically coming from breeder herds. And now a lot of the bulls are coming from AI companies' breeding programs. So that's been quite a mind-shifting experience for a lot of our breeders. And some people are very happy because genetic improvement is going up rapidly. Others look at it and say, gee, you know, I just lost a big business opportunity here. I used to sell a lot of bulls into AI. I used to sell a lot of bulls to my neighbors that they would then use. And that business has definitely changed. So that's a part of the genomics that you need to appreciate that will be a part of your business as genomics becomes more and more prevalent. And it does have a huge impact on businesses. So this is from 2016, and it looks at the top genomic sires. And remember, the genomic sires are young bulls, 1-2 years old with no progeny. We see them almost exclusively coming from North America, the United States, and Canada. Actually, if you look at this list for 2017, it's 100% coming from North America. And so the U.S. has really jumped out ahead. I think we've done that because you had your little factor there of trust in the genetic advisor, whether it was 0 or 1. I guess ours was close to 1 when we got the genomic information. And again, to show that it has a big impact on businesses, this is the I love the website, the Bullvine. They really are ways of stimulating interesting discussions. This one article that they had here was Stud Wars, like Star Wars. And they have it 2014-2016, showing that certain AI companies picked up a bigger market share. If we look at just the purebred Holstein registrations, some companies, their market share has increased by 14%, or I should say the sum of some companies have increased by 14%. I would describe them as the ones that jumped on the genomics early and have a very aggressive genomics breeding program. So they definitely have picked up market share, and that means money. And Select Sires is the poster boy, using Jerry's word, the poster boy for our AI community. Now, some of these are hard to read, and I know that, but it's the story that's important. And what we have here is the top genomic young bull. So there is semen available for these bulls for sale. It's April 2017. And what I really want to point out are the NAB numbers, because you have a lot of bulls there that are 507, the next one 507, and then the next one 7HO. So 7HO is select sires. 507 is sex semen select sires. So you have select sires, select sires, select sires, select sires, select sires. You kind of get the idea that select sires kind of jumped on this early and did a tremendous job of producing some desirable animals. Not only are they the owners of these bulls, but you can see quite a few of them have that SSI prefix. So they are the breeders of the animals. How are they doing it? What's some of the other things that have changed within our industry? We have pre-release semen and sex semen. Those two have dramatically changed our industry. So our relationships with one another, our business relationships with one another has changed. The AI companies have now have contracts with breeders, and they include access to top young bulls. And what that means is that when you have a, since everything is moving fast and the best animals are young, and as you know, young bulls don't produce that much semen. But they do produce semen. And so if you can get some semen on those young bulls, they're very, very high, very unique, you're going to distribute that semen to a certain group of farmers. And those farmers have a contract with that AI company. We call that the pre-release semen. And then usually that contract includes the agreement that if there's a bull that's born from that mating, then the AI company that provided you that semen has the first right of refusal. About 40% of the bulls that are coming into the AI companies are coming from this type of arrangement. And then when the bull is getting a little bit older, semen production is increasing, then it's this almost exclusive sale of sex semen, sex-sorted semen. So this this slide illustrates it quite well. You see in the early part, you have that the pre-release semen is being distributed to their contract herds, herds that they have a contract with. We have identification, registration of both males and females, just as you would expect if you put out conventional semen. And then there's a point where you see the numbers of heifers really takes off, and there's a small decline in number of bulls that are being identified and registered. And that great takeoff in the heifers is showing you that, yes, indeed, sex-sorted semen does work. You do get a lot more heifers. And it has some benefits in that not only are the farmers mostly happy because they're getting females, which is in the dairy industry quite important. Those are the ones that you milk. But the companies are also happy because it may be a way of preventing the spread of their top genetics to their competitors. So if they're the ones that are controlling the early release, getting those early bulls, then that should be a huge advantage. Now, I will tell you that I like this slide a lot, and I made this slide purposely for this talk, and I thought, well, okay, time's up. And then I did a little bit more investigating into it, and I found that, hey, this isn't quite working exactly as this AI company hoped. So if I look at the current top 10 sons of this bull, what's interesting is that seven of them come after this pre-release period. And basically all of those seven are owned by the competing AI companies. So this is the slide that I prepared for this talk, and this slide here is the one that I'll have to go back and see exactly what's going on. Where are they getting the semen? What are they doing? Are they getting semen from these contract herds that maybe slipping the semen out? Are they doing reverse sorting of the semen so they get back the male sperm? Just what is happening here? And this slide perfectly illustrates in the fact that, we can plan on how we want to use genomics, and we can implement that plan, but it really is a learning process, an adapting process, an adjusting process, and a very competitive process. So here we have to illustrate, this is the young bulls with semen available. So they're basically 1 year old, 1.5 years old. And these are the ones that are baby calves. So they're not old enough to produce semen. And what you see here is you do not see select dominating the way that they did just shortly. It's now a variety of different studs. And I have the term then they're free agents. And what I mean by free agents is that we have what's listed here as a requester or a nominator. And so when you do your genomic test, you can do it through a variety of companies. You can do it through an AI company. You can do it through Zoetis. You can do it through GeneSeq. You can do it through Holstein. And the GeneSeq and Zoetis, Holstein, we would call that the free agent route, because you test with them. There's no contract that you have to sell the animal, you know, first right of refusal. So we're finding that that's a very advantageous way to go, because then if you have a highly desirable animal, you can put them on the market, and that's where these huge prices are coming from. It's the prices coming from animals that do not have contractual obligation. They can be bought by any company that's out there or any breeder that's out there. And that because of this, some being out of the chute very quickly, there's other companies that are trying to catch up. And that's really what's driving these prices up to very high levels. Whether they'll stay at those high levels and for how long is anybody's guess. But that explains the environment that we're currently in today. And this is the new pedigree. I showed you that international pedigree where we had Germany and Great Britain and Canada, etc. This pedigree is an AI pedigree. So we have a bull, a very nice bull, who's owned by ABS. The sire is coming from the breeding program of Select Sires, and the dam is one that they purchased but came from Alta Genetics, the peak prefix. So the fact, again, I just want to emphasize that from a breeder's perspective, boy, things have really changed quite a bit. It's really hard to be a breeder today. You have to devote a lot more resources, financial resources, and I'll show you a bit about that. But this shows you the environment that we're existing in. So again, to emphasize competition and how it's had an impact. When you just saw our pedigree, the new pedigree, you can see that many countries they've gone domestic, U.S. first. I think I understand that phrase would be very popular within the dairy industry as explaining our breeding program. But Germany first, the Netherlands first would also explain their breeding program. So we have really gone internally as opposed to what we previously were doing in looking around the world. And there's a number of genotype exchange agreements between countries. And there's also agreements on who can get a genomic evaluation within your country and what will be the price for that genomic evaluation. So I have this listed here for Germany and also for our U.S. Entity, the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding. And this is just for the males. The prices are much cheaper for the females. But the idea is that, all of this investment is costing a lot of money, and we should have things arranged so that the people that are contributing the data, the phenotypic data that we're valuing quite a bit, if you're contributing phenotypic data into the genomic evaluations, then you should pay nothing or you should pay little to get the genomic evaluations. So if you're a full data contributor, those are the prices to get an evaluation on a bull, $15 initial and then $575 for AI. And what that means is the initial is, let's get an initial evaluation on a bull calf. If he's good, we're going to keep him. If he's not good, well, there goes our $15. But if he's good, you're going to enter him into AI, and once you make that decision to enter him into AI, you get a NAB number, then the price goes to $575 to get any further evaluations on that. And like I said, we do that. I have different pricing within the U.S. of whether you've contributed data or not. We have different pricing for different countries, whether you have exchanged your genotypes with the U.S. or not. And then we do have an open system, so all others would be anyone that around the world that would like a genomic evaluation on the U.S. scale. It would be for an AI bull, it would be $1,200. For a German bull, you can also get it there in Germany, and it would be 1,000 euros. So this is a pretty much international practice. To illustrate the competitiveness and the where we are currently, this is a description of the different genetic evaluations that are done within different countries. The top one is the U.S., followed by Germany, then Sweden, then the Netherlands, then France, and then, as we heard earlier, the single step. So I think the single step is where we're kind of coming back to. Those top current methods, very nicely explained by Daniela, where she explained how there's multiple steps. You have traditional evaluations, then you have a genomic evaluation, then you have a blending of the two pieces. And it's the single step that does it all together. And the reason why it's important is what we're calling genomic pre-selection. So what we have here, this work comes from the University of Georgia, so a very great institution doing great work, and we appreciate it. The blue line is the genomic evaluation, and the red line is the traditional evaluation. So we call that gap the bias from genomic pre-selection. And what that means is that you have all these animals. You have cows, you genomic test, you keep the good ones, you cull the low ones. On the bulls, you do the same thing, but even more intensely. And what you see is that when you do a traditional evaluation and you're not including the genomic information, so you're kind of ignoring that you've selected the best animals already, and then you put them in a traditional evaluation, those traditional evaluations come back lower. They're actually much better genetically than you're giving them credit because you're not including the genomic information into the genetic evaluations. When you do it in a single step and you include everything together, you see you bring the animals back up to their proper evaluation point and you've eliminated the bias. So that's why we're very, very interested in the single step method. It's recommended that that's the route that you're going in beef, and no question that has my endorsement. And the reason is because of this potential problem of bias. And within the dairy industry, this is really important, not only from a domestic point of view, but a lot of this information is getting moved around. So when we look at a Canadian bull that we're evaluated in the U.S. system, we actually take his traditional Canadian evaluation, deregress that, and then bring it into the U.S. system. And for Canada, vice versa, our U.S. traditional is going. So you certainly don't want that information to be biased in any way. So that's the kind of a driver for why we are looking to change our evaluations, and it's looking to be very similar to beef. And the other thing that was mentioned is that the amount of information becomes very big, very fast. So for the geneticists in the room, what we were looking at is, you know, how do you invert a matrix that's 1.6 million by 1.6 million? Well, we didn't figure that out. But what we did figure out is that if you take a subsection, subgroup of core animals, and Ignacy and his group has found that really what it's limited is by is these blocks of DNA, these segments of DNA. How many do you need? Daniela said about 10,000. That's right. It's about 10,000, 15,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. You select those core animals either randomly, or you can use a specific way of selecting them, but randomly is just as good. You can then invert 15,000 by 15,000 matrix quite easily, and then by recursive procedures get the full genomic relationship matrix. So as mentioned earlier, we have just done that for 760,000 animals that have been genotyped, and we now have 1.6 million, but we don't see it as any problem. Previously, this was a big stumbling block on why the single step wasn't introduced into the dairy industry. This problem has been resolved, so we believe that the single step will be our next next procedure. This is an older slide that's reused. Genetic evaluations at a crossroad. And on the left-hand side there, we have USDA and the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding. So that's what this slide was made up. As you may know, for many, many years, we had our genetic evaluations done by USDA, publicly funded. And then the amount of service that's required to do the genomic evaluations with the huge amount of data. We're now putting them out weekly, so there's a lot of work. So that required moving it into a private company called the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding, and that has been done, I believe, 5 years ago. But now we see another, what I think is a challenge, an opportunity, however you want to describe it. But there's a lot more proprietary data, procedures, genetic evaluations that's causing fragmentation. And it's going to be interesting to watch, to see what we do ourselves, but those on the outside to watch and see what we do. And what I mean is that we have lots of different sources of genetic evaluations. We have each country doing their own genetic evaluation. We have companies within a country doing their own genetic evaluations, and they're doing it for the same trait. And a good example of that are the health traits. Zoetis came out first with their wellness traits. ABS Global has what they call transition right. GenX just released their exclusive health traits. And then the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding will be looking to release their health trait. Now, all that is coming, and then CMEX has Immunity Plex, which is not directly on the health traits, but looks at immune responses and how you can select to enhance the immune response, which obviously is related to health. So how we handle that, whether we can merge the data, that'll be our next challenge. Competition. So I've talked about it as far as countries, AI companies. What about the breeds? And size does matter. We talk about the number of genomic tests that we have. Here we have it ranked by different breeds. So the Jerseys are the next in line, followed by Brown Swiss, Ayrshire, and Guernsey. And again, to emphasize the amount of genotyping that's going on, it's not that we've done a lot, it's that we continue to do more and more and more. That's the thing that's really quite amazing. Is as you can see here, this is broken out by year. So each year we did more than we did the previous year. And just in May, we did over 40,000 heifers, 2,500 bulls. So the data is just growing, and the amount of data influences, the amount of genotypes influences the accuracy of the genomic evaluations. The better genomic evaluations that you have, the more selection intensity, accuracy, genetic gain that you can make. And you see that it's related to, it differs by trait. So it's the low heritable trait that is really benefiting from the genomic information. So if you were to look at the Holstein breed, you say, well, gee, how would you like to improve the Holstein breed? Well, it's these low heritable traits that were the ones that we always found the more challenging to improve. And now when you look at our genetic improvement on those traits, it's really turned around and fertility is going up, productive life is longer, somatic cell scores are going down, dramatic improvement on the low heritable traits. So we're seeing quite a bit of change in our breed, very, very rapid gains in those traits that traditionally were hard to improve. And it does have an influence on breed-to-breed competition. So what we have here is the average of the bulls that are available from each of the breeds that are being marketed. So you can see for net merit dollars, the bulls currently are averaging for Holstein $635. That's about $200 more profit per cow than the Jerseys. And that's just for this year. So if you start accumulating these differences, so if you, as I believe, Holstein's here, Jersey's here, and then each year that goes by, the gap kind of grows and grows and grows. And Jersey is competitive, and Jerseys will be around. These other breeds, it's really starting to become a question of how long they can keep going. The Brown Swiss does have an advantage in that there's multiple countries that have Brown Swiss. The Jerseys is really only Denmark, and Guernseys is really not anybody to partner up with. And we're starting to see genomics in areas that we didn't anticipate to see. So this slide is really to encourage, there's many more breeds in beef. And so I really want to encourage all the beef breeds to really get on genomics and incorporate it as fast as you can. Because if you don't, and the other guys do, it's only a short time before the gap between their breed and your breed expands. So by all means, raise that confidence level from zero to one. And we can see here some unexpected results from genomic testing. So this is just like Ancestry.com. You send in your DNA and you say, oh, well, I'm 82% Irish, I'm 13% French, or, you know, whatever. And so when you send in your DNA on your cows, you get the same thing. Oh, 80% Holstein, 20% Jersey, or 80% Jersey, 20% Holstein. You say, hey, wait a second. I thought this was a purebred animal. So the Jersey breed had an aggressive grading up program. So they'll allow animals that go back and have a missing pedigree, and then they say, well, we'll record that, and we'll just bring you forward. So that's what's been happening, and now with the genomics, we have breed-specific SNPs, we have breed-based representation, like this 20% Holstein, it tells you what percentage Holstein is there, and then also Jerseys have some information on number of generations back to a known Holstein or a missing animal. But here's the Jersey top list from this past December. All the ones in yellow have Holstein genetics in them, and the one in white is a purebred Holstein, purebred Jersey. So a dramatic influx of Holstein genetics into the Jersey breed, and then I think the Jersey is, you know, I mean, they're being very open and disclosing this information and allowing their breeders to figure out exactly how they want to handle this. Some of them are saying, well, let's just go with the top genetic animals. Others say, I want to stick with the 100% pure Jersey and doing that. Herd improvement, that's really what it's all about. And we see a great opportunity, a great increase in genetic education, a combination of technologies and economic analysis. So here's the breeder competition. So you have two herds. The top herd there is a New York herd that's doing excellent job of selecting bulls, genomic testing, in vitro fertilization, embryo transfer, using sex semen. The other herd, not so much. And the point that is important here is that the gap has really widened. So before you could do things and you can say, well, okay, maybe my breeding program isn't as competitive with the breeding program of my neighbors, but it's not that big of a gap. Now the gap is getting much bigger, and the lower herd, you have to start wondering, how sustainable is that breeding program for having a profitable herd? To me, it's amazing the amount of reproductive work that's going on within the Holstein breed. And matter of fact, this term genomics program, I hadn't heard that till about a year ago. And someone was asking another farmer, so what's your genomics program? You know, always we said, well, what's your breeding program? Or what's your selection program? And now they're saying, what's your genomics program? So what's a genomics program? Basically, it's, and I should have on here, sire selection, because that's really the most important thing you can do. And then genomic testing, that's important to do. And then the reproductive technologies. So all of that is combined in your genomic program. And people are describing how they're selecting their bulls, whether they're doing genomic testing, but then how they're using the reproductive tools. So they're IVFing their top animals. You know, that varies from herd to herd, but usually, you know, top 2%, 3%. The next tier are bred with either sex semen or conventional semen, and it would be conventional if you want bulls, so you're a breeder herd. And then the bottom part of the herds are being bred to or carry embryos. And there's all sorts of variations. But it's amazing how many farms have IVF facilities right on their farms now. It's amazing how many are getting into selling embryos, as opposed, and this is starting to compete with semen. And also, it's also surprising to see the use of beef semen on the low-end Holstein bulls to produce beef. The key in having a genomic program versus not having a genomic program and being an elite breeder today versus being an elite breeder 5, 6, 7 years ago is that, you know, even 5 years ago, if you were a good breeder in the Northeast or Wisconsin and you had a 100-cow herd, you could be very competitive. Now, unless you have, you know, a 500-cow herd, a 1,000-cow herd, a 3,000-cow herd, it all comes down to the number of recipients. That really is a key factor in what's driving genetic programs and who are the breeders today versus who were the breeders yesterday. We're doing so much ET work and using of sex semen that we now have animals that we can breed to beef bulls, and USDA has a fertility evaluation on Angus sires being bred to Holstein cows. So much flushing going on that you actually see the cow's ability to produce eggs, good embryos, is becoming a trait. This is a recent publication. You see that the number of good embryos, they're averaging around 5, and they range from 0 to 26. So if a cow is a bad embryo producer, she's not a good investment. If she's a great embryo producer, you can pay more money for her. And this animal here is advertised. She's currently bred. She's currently bred, and she's ready to IVF. So she's bred, and now you're going to IVF her. And that makes her more valuable because she's ready. She's coming from a cow family that produces lots of good embryos, averaging 7 as opposed to traditional 5. We really haven't settled in into a this is the breeding program for dairy cattle. There's still a lot of variation. These are some large herds, so they had 500 heifers that were registered in 2006, so larger herds. What I have here is the percent that are genomically testing. It's all over the board. So some of them, this top group that's anywhere between 30% up to 100%, those would be herds that are have a genomic program, and the other herds are not utilizing it all that much. The information that we're getting and we're providing back to the herds is leading to some very helpful discussions amongst those. The last slide where I showed the herds, these are two that was picked out. One has a aggressive genomics program. The other one does not have one. And you can see that there's a $900 difference in lifetime profit per cow between these two herds. So the idea is to have this information, bring it to the farmers, discuss with them, get their attention, and hopefully change things for that bottom herd and have that herd become more competitive with a more competitive genetics program. Just a couple of comments on future projects. Sequencing, this was also mentioned earlier, and I have the exact same conclusion. We're not selecting for any specific genetic variants at this time. We're finding what those are and adding them to the chips that we currently have. And this is the same slide that we showed earlier. And so you can see that we have an improvement in reliability, or what you would call accuracy. The traits here are the more lowly heritable traits: productive life, somatic cell score, daughter pregnancy rate, cow conception rate, heifer conception rate. To me, I love this slide. I figured I was born a quantitative geneticist. I've lived my whole life as a quantitative geneticist. And by golly, I'm going to die a quantitative geneticist. So there may be genes that we'll get excited about and we'll introduce and we'll select for and all that. But it's not going to be a big deal. The quantitative EPDs that we have, that's the way to go. Imputation, we don't give it as enough glamour as it should get. It's very, very important. We have here a list of all the different SNP chips that are available within the dairy industry. All of them have to be imputed to the same base in any one year. There seems to be a more popular chip. So you see the 21,000 SNP chip there being the one in 2016. And then this is a topic that we're working on that I like. We talk about Mendelian sampling. Mendelian sampling is you make a mating, and then were you lucky to get good combination of genes, or were you unlucky to get a bad combination of genes? And it's that whole getting the genes to come together, and the spread that you see is the Mendelian sampling from any one mating. If it has small Mendelian sampling, they're all smooshed together. If it has large Mendelian sampling, it's wider apart. And we see that. We've seen it for years. Here's two bulls. They have essentially the same evaluation for PTA fat, but when you look at their offspring, you see Baxters are much more spread out, much higher Mendelian sampling. So if you're a commercial dairyman, maybe the top bull Denim is one that you'd be interested in because they're more uniform. If you're a breeder and you're really going for those outliers, it's the Baxter that you'd be more interested in gambling on to get something that's quite unique. Now, I said I wanted to be a quantitative geneticist. I will be one. But we are looking at specific genotypes. And this is coming directly from the farmers. And the farmers saying, I'm doing a lot of genomic testing, and I can produce a lot of milk, and I can segregate that milk. I can create milk of one specific genotype and sell that to whatever market wants it. And if I do that, I want to be compensated. You guys talk about this all the time in your value-added products. And we're looking at that, too. We're looking at whether there's any genetic variants that are out there. A2 milk is one that's currently getting some buzz. A lot of it is done outside, research done outside of the U.S., so we're actually getting a project going with Tufts University to see if it does affect people's ability to digest milk. And if it does, you know, we can easily produce a tanker full of milk, of A2 milk, and if we're compensated for it, everyone will be happy. So that's what's happening in the dairy industry. It's great times. It's exciting times. But in some regards, maybe that's the that explains it perfectly, as the Chinese curse says, may you live in exciting times.